Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for being here. I'll welcome you to our House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development on this fine February 25th, 2015. I believe we have a quorum at this point. On our agenda today, the first order of business is an informational hearing, and I will open the informational hearing. Do I have to open an informational hearing? On the status of Oregon's public transit system. So I believe everyone in the room is interested in transit. So we appreciate your willingness to participate today. I have...
I'm looking for that later.
Yeah, okay. Mr. Pollock, Mr. McFarlane, Kilcoyne, am I pronouncing that correctly? And Julie Brown. And if you'd like to do two at a time, fine. Or if you all four want to come up, bring up a chair. Whatever makes you the most comfortable. Pleased to have you here today. Thank you.
Thank you. And good afternoon, Chair McCune, members of the committee. I'm Alan Pollock, the general manager for Salem-Keizer Transit. We also have the distinct pleasure of being the president of the Oregon Transit Association. The association is a statewide association whose mission is to support and advocate on behalf of the public transit industry in Oregon. The association membership consists of transit districts, transportation districts, for-profit and nonprofit service providers, vendors and businesses who support the industry, as well as cities and counties. Public transit is in every community in the state, from large urban areas to small rural towns, where transit especially plays an important role in critical lifeline services. Today, you'll hear from a mix of agencies from large urban to mid-sized to small who all have differing but similar issues and needs. One of the important issues for the association and its members is the importance of a dedicated state funding source for transit operations. Without that support, it really puts the full burden of operations at the local level. And in the transit industry, the two most commonly looked at funding sources are sales tax and gas tax. And without access to those, it really makes it difficult for transit agencies in Oregon. What transit agencies do well, however, and you'll hear this today, is they use the state funding they do receive to leverage federal dollars. A perfect example of an agency who's struggling to maintain adequate service is right here in Salem, Salem-Keizer Transit. We eliminated Saturday service in 2009 as a budget balancing measure, but more importantly, it's significantly disrupted the lives of people needing transit service on the weekends and trying to connect with the places they want to go. You know, Salem, unfortunately, is the largest state capital in the nation that doesn't provide Saturday service. There's only six in the country, and by population, we're the largest of the six. So what you're going to hear today really reinforces the whole issue of transit from a statewide perspective. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony so you can hear from service providers right now. So with that, I'll turn over to Neil.
Thank you.
Chair McEwen, Vice Chair Davis, and Gorsuch. My name is Neil McFarlane. I'm TriMet General Manager, and I'm pleased to be here. And thank you for the opportunity to testify and tell you a little bit of an update regarding TriMet. For those of you who might not be familiar, TriMet serves 25 cities in Washington, Multnomah, and Clackamas County with a combined population of about 1.5 million. We provide bus, light rail, commuter rail, and paratransit, as we call it, Lyft service, particularly focused on service to seniors and people with disabilities. We also partner with the City of Portland in terms of operating the Portland streetcar. When we talk about TriMet, we often describe our four major missions and talk about our performance related to each of those four missions. Those missions are, first of all, getting employees to work and customers to business. Second, easing congestion in a most cost-effective way, particularly during peak hours. And third, providing that critical service for seniors, people with disabilities, kids who don't yet have the ability or the age to drive, and providing that key opportunity and link to the community. And fourth, in helping to shape the region and the way it grows so that we can all benefit, enjoy the benefits of a great, livable region that we all enjoy. So how are you doing in fulfilling these missions? Just a few statistics. Related to getting employees to work, some 320,000 times a day, someone steps across the threshold of a TriMet vehicle. And over a third of those are actually work-related trips. Annually, you add that up, it equates to about 100 million rides a year. A third of those are really directly providing employment opportunities. When you think about particular destinations, downtown Portland, for example, 45% of the rush hour commuters to downtown arrive there via public transit. Regarding easing congestion, we have been, I think, more successful than many other urban areas in that mission. If you begin to think about the Portland metropolitan area, we're the 24th largest metropolitan area in the region by population, but we're number 9 in per capita ridership. So one of the results of that is when you look at our ridership characteristics, 78% of our riders actually have access to a car. So they're choosing public transit because it's more effective, efficient, or cost-effective for them. But that has a positive effect on freeing capacity on the roadway system for freight and other high-value services. And another example of that, our MAX system, related to the very busy Sunset and Banfield corridors, carries 1 in 3 commuters in each of those corridors. So again, traffic would be perhaps a third worse, which would not, frankly, be possible during the peak hours in terms of total.
Vice Chair Davis would agree with you on that.
Well, those very very busy routes. Regarding our social service mission to very important elements of our community, we provide over 12 million rides a year to seniors and people with disabilities. And we particularly are proud of our paratransit service, our Lyft service, which provides 1 million rides a year to people who would otherwise not be able to fulfill a high quality of life, access to jobs and health care and many other services. So again, critical service. It's not a very efficient service in terms of the cost per ride, but absolutely essential to those who use it and rely on it to be a participating member of our society. Finally, the fourth mission, which is helping our region manage growth. We've been working with our community really for 20, 30 years in terms of beginning to shape the region around a public transit system so that that system can be successful. And I think we see the results of that with much of the housing development in around our frequent service lines and our MAX lines throughout the region right now. Experts are telling us that our region will be growing by 4 Hillsboroughs over the next 20 years. And that's the challenge that we face, is keeping up with that demand with a transportation system which is fundamentally sized at, and placed within our region. So we're working very hard, and again, that's one of the reasons we participated in the transportation forum related to the ultimate transportation package, because keeping the region mobile is a key goal for us all, of course. We're also working with our partners looking at some of the key corridors. Powell Division is an interesting corridor that is very right now carries over 18,000 riders a day. And we're looking at upgrading that service with bus rapid transit service, which would be very different from what we've done before, but our partners in Eugene have led the way there. Again, meeting the challenges of growth won't be easy, but that's what we're working toward with all of our partners and in the metropolitan area. And I would say that as we think about that, we know that we have some challenges. One is to make sure that the systems that we operate are efficient systems and are systems that actually offer great value to our customers and our taxpayers. And like all businesses, we have to continually look at our service and our cost structure. And I would particularly just note that over the last year, last fall, we were very successful in achieving a negotiation with our labor union that really realigned healthcare benefits in a way that makes TriMet financially sustainable for the long term. This chart that you see is actually shows a red and blue line that actually was the trajectory we were on given the current benefit structure we had prior to our settlement. We've moved up to a very flat now green line that begins to show that we have the ability to manage around a sustainable line of service. We've also adopted a strategic financial plan. The board has put a great deal of attention into that in terms of how to address long-term objectives related to legacy benefits, but also thinking forward about the capital replacement needs of the system over the long haul. Again, one of our challenges is continuing to refresh the system and the capital and capital facilities in the system over the long run and keep everything in a state of good repair. With our cost, yes, sir.
Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks. This is very interesting. You're well aware that there have been concerns from members, former members of this committee about, I think, unfunded pension liability was a concern. Does this chart include that piece?
Yes.
And does it include capital, potential capital expenditures as well?
Yes, it does. And matter of fact, the reason this line perhaps wiggles around the axis is that capital is not always smooth. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we think ahead to the 2026 is the year that our first light rail vehicles turn 40, which is the replacement cycle for a light rail vehicle. So there are a great deal of cost associated with that. So you begin to see us beginning to manage that in different ways. But all of that is included in this financial forecast.
That's great to hear. Thank you. And the quick bump that we see looks like at 15, where the green line sort of hits stability. Could you talk about how did we get there? How do we all of a sudden jump to stability in a very short period of time?
Because, frankly, there was very constructive and pretty dramatic change in the union contract, particularly related to health care. And there was this was actually a long, hard slog in a negotiation. But at the end of the day, I think everybody felt really good about the outcome of it. It was approved, in my understanding, by a very large majority of the union workforce. But it includes moving to sort of a standard 80-20% coinsurance plan with deductibles and employee participation and premiums. More detail than you probably want, but the number one is that those cost changes were quite dramatic and allowed us to move to a point of stability. But I would also have to really say that part of, and where I was sort of going to go next in these remarks, is that as the economy has begun to rebound, so does the payroll tax, which is our basic revenue source. And so that, you know, all boats rise with the rising tide, and we're one of those boats in this case.
Thank you.
Sir, how long was the contract that you negotiated? What's the end date?
It was 4 years.
4 years.
Although 1 year had already passed, so 3 years prospectively.
Okay, thank you. I think Vice Chair Gorsuch had a question.
Well, I just want to step back. So we had earlier, we were talking about Powell Division as well. Another corridor that's of interest to folks like Representative Doherty on the west side is Barber Boulevard.
Yes.
Do we have a similar sort of idea maybe for Barber Boulevard, or is it still in the kind of
Still in
thinking
the planning
stage.
And thinking okay. stage. And one of the things I would like to note is that we are key partners with Metro and the City of Portland and the other jurisdictions, Washington County and the major cities there, in that effort. And it is a planning effort at this stage again. Both bus rapid transit as well as potentially light rail are on the table. And the schedule is that as we move through these planning studies, by about the end of the year, we're at a more formative stage where we're in a position to begin to describe what the recommended project might be.
Okay. Thank you.
Very good.
Other questions? Please continue.
Well, let me just note with that we have made a great deal of progress both in the cost structure and with a improving economy. And I'm pleased to be able to report to you that we actually will be at a higher level of service in our region in 2015 than we were before the Great Recession, just barely. So we have been able to bridge the service reductions that we had to make during the years of the Great Recession and begin to add back particularly some very effective service. And one of the things that we do are very proud of is that our service is very heavily used. And so the statistic that you see illustrated here begins to describe that in terms of boarding rides per hour, we're a very effective system. And compared to our West Coast major transit peers, we're somewhere between 17% and 20%. I'm not remembering the exact number. Better than many of those other systems. The other thing we've been able to do, mention this briefly, is turn our attention to the capital. We have been on an accelerated program of replacing buses. This year alone, we'll have about 65 new buses brought into the fleet. By the end of this year, all of our fleet will be low floor, air conditioned, and we'll still have some, as we call them, orange stripe buses. Most of the buses will be new, and the base fleet will be a very high quality service. And as I noted, our first light rail line will soon be 30 years old, and it's a rail line that, as you all know, is used very hard and very frequently. And we are beginning to invest in both rail replacement as well as platform rehabilitation related to sort of maintaining, again, a good state of good repair throughout that Blue Line corridor. As I mentioned, we're expected to grow by four Hillsboroughs in the next – that's about 260,000 jobs. And one of our particular challenges is meeting the demands of the employers in the metropolitan area for mobility and getting their employees to work. The Portland Business Alliance Cost of Congestion Study tells us that with growth, we can expect to see almost a 50% increase in car trips and a 75% increase in truck trips by 2040. And even with committed and existing projects underway, we would expect to see with that a threefold increase in congestion. And so that's not the future that we all want to see. And that growth will put enormous strain on our transportation system. And that's why we are obviously very much interested in a balanced transportation package, both roads and transit, because that's the way we've solved problems in the metropolitan area is to make sure that we provide that that choice. So maybe with that, I would just note that we are continuing to also work with employers and throughout the Tri-County area on other more, I would call, innovative services, such as shuttle services. We offer a shuttle for employers in the Tualatin area on Swan Island. A variation of that in Representative McLean's district is that for GroveLink service, which is offering, again, service in low-density areas connecting to the trunk lines that TriMet provides. Those are the kinds of models that we'd love to see expanded and grow over time in terms of providing high-quality service throughout our district in a cost-effective way. I did want to just mention a little bit, too, some of the upcoming projects and enhancements we have underway. Needless to say, we're very excited about the opening of the Portland-Milwaukee project, the Orange Line, as it will be known to our riders. September 12, 2015, we'll open the line. We'll have a series of events leading to that. I hope that as many of you as possible can join us on what will be, a very exciting occasion. You should also know that as the investments in this line continued, we've added $40 million in roadway improvements and $65 million in bike and pedestrian improvements. So it's not just transit that gets built with these major projects. I also just wanted to note that this has been an important economic development project for the state during a period of time when, frankly, we were needing the kinds of jobs that this project produced. As of February of this year, the project had created 13,250 jobs in our region, more to come. 546 firms were included in the project. 80% of those are based in Oregon. And these aren't just metropolitan area firms, as Chair McEwen would note, that American Bridge Manufacturing from Reedsport provided girders for our Kellogg Bridge as part of the project.
And watch them being manufactured. Thank you very much.
And the leadership of that firm has indicated that that work provided about 15 jobs added and was able to recall 10 employees that were otherwise laid off. So those are the kinds of benefits that really do resonate throughout the state with projects like this. And as you know, the state legislature was a major investor in this project, $250 million of lottery funds. And again, want to thank you for your support and help as we begin to address the
needs of that quarter. Mr. McFarland, how long did this project take start to finish from the inception to the opening in September?
Well, I could say 20 years, but it probably has been that long from the first environmental studies. From this from the most recent restart, if you will, of the project, probably closer to 10.
Yes, sir. Vice Chair Gorsuch.
And one of the things, and we were talking about this before, one of the things is that it will also enhance some of the bus lines, like the PAL, which won't have to deal with as much of the congestion problems. So it's good for the trains, but also some of the buses get to use this as well.
So as Vice Chair Gorsuch noted, this bridge will actually provide a transit way between Southeast Portland and downtown Portland for not just light rail, but for some of them, our major bus lines, including the Powell bus line. And also will provide a link of the Portland streetcar across the river. So buses, light rail, streetcar, bikes, and pedestrians will be heavily using this bridge in the future. I did want to just note that we're also continuing to focus on the future of transit, and Vice Chair Gorsuch noted some of the projects that we're continuing to work on, the Powell Division Corridor 1, won't say anything more about that, but also the Southwest Corridor, which we think is a really very key investment in the regional system. And again, we'll be working with all the constituents under the leadership of Metro to begin to identify what those alternatives long-term need to be. It's a corridor of a high level of congestion right now, but also incredible potential for growth. We see a high responsibility to begin to address the transportation needs in that corridor. And it's again, it's not just transit. It is roads. It's bicycles, pedestrians. It's a whole slew of transportation needs on really I-5 South from downtown Portland. I also just wanted to note that we're busy doing what we call service enhancement plans throughout our region. We use the west side of our district as a prototype for that, and a plan was put together for that and completed, and actually beginning to invest in some of the recommendations of that plan. We'll soon have a plan done for the southwest sector of our region, and at the same time doing the rest of the district as well. And that's a process where we actually work closely with major employers, employer groups, chambers, local officials, community organizations, as well as citizens, in trying to define what the future of the transit system in their neighborhoods and areas and cities should be. And so that process has proven very effective in terms of beginning to get real focus on what transit improvements need to be in the future. I wanted to mention one other thing, which is we are working on, which is an electronic fare system. We have been one of the first systems to actually move to some level of smartphone-related payment, and that's been a very popular device as we've, with a local firm, developed a payment app for smartphones, which now contribute about 10% of our overall fare revenue, has been adopted much more readily than we expected. But our plans over the next couple of years will be to actually develop a smart card system that would also allow both smartphones as well as chip-embedded credit cards to be used as a payment device, which we think will really reduce what we call the tyranny of the fare box and make it easy for our customers to access our system, even if they don't have a quarter in their pocket like they should. With that, I would just note that I think we have a very well-regarded transportation system, balanced transportation system in the Portland metropolitan area. I think TriMet has done a very good job of providing its share of work in terms of getting the transportation system done. But we have some huge challenges of growth ahead of us as the metropolitan area continues to develop and continues to grow. And that's our biggest challenge, is meeting those challenges. And we need to do that in recognition of all the missions that I went through, including our social compact with seniors and people with disabilities, and make sure that we continue a high level of service for really everybody who needs it in the metropolitan area. So we're excited about the opportunity, and I really am very grateful for the opportunity to present a little bit of this information to you.
Thank you. I think Vice Chair Gorsuch has a question.
Yes, I am the transportation freak here, especially for trains and buses, so sorry. I did want to ask you one thing. We know that one of the problems is downtown for light rail. I mean, light rail functions well, but it has to go very, very slowly. And so I know it would be very costly and difficult. Have we at least thought of maybe ways that we could, I don't know, make Max move through downtown more easily?
We've thought about it, and you're right. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
what we have thought about, and frankly, as we built the new alignment on 5th and 6th Avenue, the mall alignment, we spread the stations out much further than they were in the original line. So we did learn a little bit from that earlier line's experience. And so I think that's one of the, I think, solutions long term. But what's difficult about it is every station is somebody's home station, and there's a lot of ownership of each of those places, and so it's a very big conversation to have on that.
Is there no way to go up or down?
You know, there were some studies of that. Obviously, quite expensive. So
that's what I anticipated. Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much. This has been a wonderful presentation, and I appreciate at the end your reference to challenges. Just out of self-interest for myself and my constituents in the Southwest Corridor,
yes.
Could you update us on the progress in both the study and the work groups that have been going on there and where we're headed?
Absolutely. So we are, again, and again, TriMet is a participant with under Metro's leadership right now in terms of undertaking this overall effort. And there's a steering group that includes Washington County and City of Tigard and City of Tualatin, City of Sherwood, City of Durham, and, of course, City of Portland, TriMet, and Washington County. And all of those agencies are participating and have pooled the resources necessary to go through what we would call sort of the first phase of development studies. And so that is looking at, again, the choice between light rail and bus rapid transit and looking at potential alignments. So a lot of that work is underway. The way these processes go, we develop a bunch of information about the broad basket of alternatives, as we say, and then begin to narrow them down through this process. So I think the first step of narrowing is actually anticipated about June of this year, and then more final narrowing to one single, probably at that time, still fat line on the map by the end of the calendar year. Where we would go with that then is beginning to seek support for moving into a formal environmental process with federal government participation as we begin to invest or begin to suggest what those long-term improvements should be. And again, I note that I think everyone affiliated with the effort understands that this is really something where we need to both think about transit as well as some of the key congested roadway links that are now quite obvious in the Southwest Corridor. I hope that answered your question.
Thank you, Paul.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And have you examined the cost for example, a tunnel between Newburgh and downtown along 99? What that
they have
might
a machine
be.
Up in Seattle they might
I think,
loan
yes,
you.
The Seattle one might be done in time.
I like that. And under downtown, too.
I know that they're trying to get rid of a tunnel boring machine in Seattle these days, but I'm not sure. No, we haven't.
That's fascinating when you start to think about it. I believe Representative McLean had a question or comment.
It's a question comment kind of thing. I first of all want to thank you for all the updated information, and I think that Representative Gorsuch, you know, got at a point that is the challenge for transit, and that is that a good ride means short time and it means a lot of stops. And then how do you do those together, you know? And I really appreciate the fact that the West Side sort of plan that you've been working on with the employers and others basically have been trying to deal with that, you know, because both the train and the bus are, again, a good ride means the shortest time and the most stops because they don't want to walk that last mile or they don't want to walk across a parking lot that is a mile long. And so I really appreciate the effort of keeping that together and trying to keep that as a high priority of continuing to look for ways to improve the system overall. And I really think that the employers are definitely part of the solution, whether it be the shuttle or whatever else they can do to help that system also be integrated. But thank you, and I look forward to hearing about the other transits.
Great. Thank you. So, Mr. McFarland, if you had a crystal ball, if the bridge took, in essence, 20 years 10 solid years. How long do you anticipate it will take the project on the south on the southwest side to be complete?
Well, I could
and,
maybe.
And how can we help you shorten that time frame?
Well, I excellent question. My sense is that anytime you're talking about a major investment like that, you're probably talking about at least a decade of real work. And so you've got about 5 years of planning and fundraising, frankly, and at least 5 years then of the detailed engineering construction. So I think that's realistically probably the minimum, and I'd say 10 to 12 is sort of where that would be. And obviously, I think as this project develops, the partnerships, the partners, the cities, the counties, the others involved will be wanting to have some conversation with how is the state a partner. I mean, there is obviously a very important role that I-5 plays in statewide economy, and this would be seen as one of the major, frankly, solutions to maintaining that capacity for high-value goods movements and other sure. transportation.
Very important. I spent 8 years serving on a board of directors in Portland, and I was up once a month. And as a ruralite, I learned how to use Macs when I'd arrive at the airport. I had to have someone go down and teach me how to buy my ticket and make sure I had it when I climbed on the train. And I enjoyed your services on a regular basis for many years. And it's very important, the work that you do, and we're grateful.
Oh, great.
And thank you for being here today.
Well, thank you. And thank you for riding.
I have no idea how to ride your buses, however. That would be a whole nother lesson I would have to take.
We'll have to go on a field trip.
We would have to go on a field trip. I'd be happy to do that.
Ride around.
I'd be happy to do that. I believe next we have Mr. Kilcoyne. Am I saying that correctly?
You are saying that correctly, yes.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Good Irish name, I assume.
It is, yes. Well, Chair McEwen and members of the committee, my name is Ron Kilcoyne. I am the General Manager of Lane Transit District, serving the Eugene-Springfield metropolitan area. LTD started in 1970 as one of the only two statutorily created transit agencies in the state, TriMet being the other. And in that time frame, we grew from 18 buses serving 13 routes to over 100 buses serving 36 routes and serving most of urbanized Lane County. And during this time, we've done this by raising our tax rate only once, and we do have authorization to increase it another tenth of 1%. We provide 11.1 million rides per year, and our buses drive 3.5 million miles per year, which is equal to 140 trips around the earth. We serve 23 communities in Lane County, ranging from Cottage Grove to the south, Junction City to the north, Bonita to the west, and communities along the McKenzie River to the east. In 2014, last year, we were recognized by the American Public Transportation Association as the top mid-sized transit agency in the United States. And in addition to the fixed route service, we provide nearly 80,000 paratransit rides to elderly and persons with disabilities. And our ride source call center brokers additional 200,000 annual rides for individuals in the Horican Health Plan and about 15 other programs. We, as Neil mentioned, TriMet was the Portland region is number 9 in per capita transit ridership. The Eugene-Springfield area is number 19 in per capita transit ridership. So that means Oregon has two of the top 20 regions in terms of per capita transit usage in the country. I think that's pretty impressive that we have that concentration here. Also, in terms of productivity, we are also in the top 25 of all transit systems in the country in terms of productivity, in terms of boardings per hour of service. Our system is very intensely used. The MX Bus Rapid Transit System provides fast, efficient service between Eugene and Springfield. It is a flexible system. In places it operates with dedicated travel lanes. Other places it shares lanes with turning traffic only. And then in areas that are not congested, it runs in mixed traffic. It operates every 10 minutes. And it serves iconic stations with level boarding that provides for fast getting on and off, very similar to the way light rail works. The first line opened in 2007, and within a year doubled the ridership in that particular corridor, now carries about three times as many customers in that corridor. The second line opened in 2010, and then the next line will open in the fall of 2017. And I say lines, actually, it's all one line. These are basically phases. and currently provides 25% of the ridership of our system rides that. Now, I'd like to focus on two of the many benefits of transit. One is how we help people succeed, and secondly, how we help grow the economy. Helping people succeed. For those who do not live in the Eugene Springfield area, maybe their only experience with LTD is riding one of our football game day shuttles, which transport nearly 10,000 fans per home game to Autzen Stadium. But and I know that when I first came to the region, I talked to people, I said, I was working LTD, and said, oh, yeah, I love those football shuttles. But we do a lot more. Driving is expensive and time-consuming, and quality transit service allows people to choose to save money and ride a different way. A majority of our riders are choice riders, meaning that they do have access to a vehicle, but they choose to ride the bus. And this is possible because 92% of our households in the metro area are within half mile of a bus stop. But for students, we also make college more affordable, and we also save public colleges money. We serve both the University of Oregon and Lane Community College, and about half of our riders are students. We make it less expensive for colleges to operate and for students to attend because, for example, there on any given day, school day, there are 30,000 people on the U of O campus, but only 3,000 parking spaces. So, and then building new garages would cost millions and waste valuable limited real estate. So having that service is a do. We also provide very high-frequency service both on MX but also with some of our regular routes to both Lane Community College and University of Oregon, which makes it easy for students to travel between campuses and cross-enroll. And students can live in less expensive housing away from campus because they have these good transportation options. We also allow seniors to remain independent. Our rides, as I mentioned earlier, our ride-source paratransit service offers 80,000 rides for seniors and people with disabilities who are unable to use our fixed route service. Demand for ride-source has increased 100% over the past 10 years, and it continues to grow rapidly with aging population. Top destinations include dialysis, doctor's appointments, and grocery shopping. And this is a federal unfunded mandate that costs us roughly $6 million a year to operate. And we're subsidizing through our general fund, which means it limits our ability to invest in service, additional fixed route service to serve the community. And because of the recession, we are currently providing about 17% fewer service hours than we did prior to the recession. So unlike, and although we will be able to add some service back this year, unlike TriMet, we are not anywhere near our pre-recession levels of service. The RideSource Call Center houses 17 transportation programs, including the Oregon Health Plan, Veterans Transportation. This consolidation allows for cost sharing. It also allows for trip sharing, which minimizes cost and maximizes efficiency. One call center allows people to get a ride no matter of their eligibility. We figure it out on the back end as to what program they're eligible for, and it allows reservations in advance. That provides predictability and stability. Now, how does transit grow the community? I mean, transit is an amenity that makes our region more attractive, just as parks and good schools and public safety. It is a tool to attract top talent and recruit new businesses, and I know that talking with the individuals responsible for economic development, Representative Lively being one of them for a while, is that how often businesses wanting to relocate to the region want to know how good is the transit service? Is there good transit service there? The fixed guideway, like MX, also drives economic development. That the permanence there allows developers to know that they can develop. And, in fact, there's been about $200 million in investment along the Franklin Boulevard corridor. And we're continually hearing about people who are buying property because of its proximity to MX, including the future West Eugene MX line, as well as businesses that advertise and apartments that advertise close to MX. And I'd like to just kind of close talking about how LTD is funded. Our operating budget is $49 million. Approximately 80% of our operating budget is spent on actual service provision. Two-thirds of our operating budget comes from the payroll tax. But Oregon as a state, the state government only provides approximately 3% of the operating funds for transit statewide. The national average is 24%. So with that, I'd like to close, and I'll be happy to answer any questions or that any of the members of the committee has.
Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Oh, hi. I have a question. In terms of your rural area service, mm-hmm. and you mentioned the McKenzie River Valley, mm-hmm. how far out do you have service on the McKenzie?
We go all the way up to the Ranger Station.
So that's
about
how many
60 miles?
About 60 miles.
Downtown Eugene,
okay.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit like the Estacada bus, but it would be maybe interesting in terms of the Columbia Gorge. I know I've harped to Aaron about this before, but if TriMet did something similar out the gorge, mm-hmm. Is that a fairly popular, is it fairly well used?
Yeah, it is. It is fairly well used. During the week, we get both rangers that are riding up to the ranger station, and we get people that live out there that are riding regularly in to Eugene Springfield to work. And on weekends, we have people that go up there for hiking and biking.
Yeah,
in fact,
so.
You know, our buses only can handle 3 bikes in the bus, but on that route, we do allow people to ride bikes. Sometimes we'll get maybe 20 bikes on a on the bus inside.
So I imagine that's really great for people who want to be able to mm-hmm. get out of Eugene Springfield, but mm-hmm. they maybe don't have a car, don't want to take their car out there.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
So is that a one-way trip? So they're going out and then riding back?
Yeah. Yeah. If they're taking their bikes, usually they want to, it's that they're taking it one way and then riding the other direction.
Nice. Yes. Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for a fascinating presentation, and I'm particularly interested in your experience with bus rapid transit. What were the elements that allowed you to choose it? Why did you select it over light rail or other modes that were potentials? What was the process in funding? Because I believe there was some federal funding as well. And what have been some of the peaks and valleys and how you've had so much success in implementing it?
Well, initially looked at three, back in the 90s, let me backtrack a little bit. Back in the 90s, their decision was we need to do something different in order to both attract more people onto transit, but also to operate more efficiently, because as traffic grew, as well as ridership was growing, you know, we could be adding 1% a year in service hours just to maintain the status quo. And we felt we needed to break out of that rut. So we looked at three options. We looked at express bus. We looked at bus rapid transit, which was new at that time. There were no bus rapid transit systems in the United States. And we looked at light rail. Express bus works best kind of in a peak direction type travel, and we were looking at something to be more of an all-day bi-directional travel. And light rail, we felt the densities of the area just did not support the high capital investment of light rail. So bus rapid transit seemed to be the good hybrid in that it provided that all-day frequency, and with stations with level boarding, it really does emulate light rail, only it's rubber tired. So that was how the decision came to be about. There was a number of funding sources, but as each of these three phases have come along, federal small starts funding has become the dominant one. And we were one of the first agencies in the country to work with, use small starts, working with the FTA to come up with small starts as an approach for funding BRT. That has a downside in that the federal, and I know the question, some of the questions that came to Neil about, you know, how long does it take to get? Basically, when you're using federal money, it does take longer. If you could fund something without any federal dollars, you could probably do it a lot quicker. I have seen rail projects, commuter rail projects, be built in like 2 years because they didn't use any federal money. So that part of that is going through all the hoops. Our West Eugene project, for example, that planning on that started in 2007. It's going to open in 2017, 10 years, once again, for BRT. And we're not building a bridge across the Willamette River, or we're building a couple pedestrian bridges, but that's not a – we're not building a major bridge along there or doing some of the major things that occurred in the TriMet project. So that's – I think that is one of the challenges. We've used basically lottery bonds and some Connect Oregon fund, mostly lottery bonds and a little bit of Connect Oregon funds for the balance, specifically on the West Eugene project. In terms of the success, the first line was a success immediately. It replaced regular service. We took out the regular service and put in the BRT service, same frequency. So it wasn't that it ran more often, because that regular route was running every 10 minutes. But just the combination of, I guess, the faster service and people actually perceiving that it was even faster than it really was, the reliable service, not getting stuck in traffic, pretty predictable service. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the stations being iconic, being identifiable with that level boarding. Ridership doubled in the first year. And right now we're carrying about three times as many passengers in that quarter, that first section quarter, than we were than we were prior to that.
And now, Mr. Davis.
And are the buses themselves nicer is the wrong word to use, but maybe one of the attractive pieces of BRT throughout the world has been the buses are an upgrade.
Yes.
I haven't seen pictures of what your BRT buses look compared to the traditional buses.
Okay. They are. I mean, they're articulated buses because of the way we configure. They actually have five doors. So like you can board, depending on where the station is, some are boarding on the left time, some on the right side. There are only three transit systems in the country that do that. Cleveland and San Bernardino are the only other two that have that kind of boarding. But they are articulated buses. They're about 63 feet long. We do use a different paint scheme on them. And, of course, you can roll your bicycles on. We also had a feature about the wheelchairs can roll back, which means that they don't have to be tied down. If they can be, that's options there, but most people prefer just to roll back, which also makes for faster boarding because then the driver doesn't have to get up and assist. So that allows for much faster. And again, the disabled community helped design that, and that's one of the positive features.
That's great. Thank you.
One more point.
Yes, sir.
And one more point. Thank you. I find it fascinating talking about BRT. What's the distance between your stations, your average?
On average, a third of a mile.
Okay.
Representative Lyman.
Madam Chair, I might just make one comment to reinforce how successful MX has been. I ride it frequently between Springfield and Eugene when I work, and my grandchildren and I ride it often. Besides, they call it the Papa's Green Bus. Yeah. But nonetheless, I can tell you that there's certain times of the day that Papa's Green Bus doesn't have room for Papa because of all those other people riding it, which is, it's amazing. It really is amazing if you watch how that loads up. And it's not just college students, but a lot of the college students using it. Hmm. But certain times of the day, I mean, I load downtown Springfield, and Ron can attest, many times early morning downtown Springfield, that bus is absolutely full, leaving for people going to Eugene, most cases for jobs, but for other things. And so it's a tremendous success.
Wonderful. You answered my question. I was going to ask what the status of the West Eugene project was. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you have a couple of years to go.
We have a couple of years to go, but we've almost finished cutting down the trees that we had to cut down, which, of course, is the most, which...
Oh, it's painful.
It's always painful, although we did a lot of work. We worked with Friends of Trees. We planted 50 trees in the surrounding neighborhood back in December, and by the time the project's done, we'll have planted twice as many trees as we've cut down, and we'll plant them, and they'll be given more space to grow, because many of the trees actually were in very poor health, and people didn't realize that, but they were arborists were saying, you know, really, these trees should come down, so we're doing that. Utility relocation is about finished, and they're ready to start the real construction probably next week.
Oh, that's great. That's very good news. Mm-hmm. I have another kind of in-the-weeds question. I know Mr. McClone and I have had discussions about this, and he's been very helpful in enlightening some folks down in my area about this conversation. But on your issue of non-emergent medical, we've run into some conversations around... we have a dialysis clinic in Coos Bay. People come from Brookings.
Mm-hmm.
and the emergent transit, we send cars down to pick them up, bring them back. We have six people. The question is, can you put them all in a van, coordinated on the same day so everybody's on the same Monday, Wednesday, Friday schedule? And the difficulty comes around HIPAA and who is willing to share a ride and who is not willing to share a ride. Is that something that you have addressed, or is that something that's been a topic of conversation with your non-emergent medical transport?
Well,
and have you dealt with it?
Well, we do try to consolidate rides as best we can. I mean, the way the call center works is that people initially call in to be certified for which programs that they're, you know, whether it's, and as I mentioned, we have about 17 different programs that we support. So we identify what programs they are eligible for, and then when they call for a ride, we can determine which program funds or supporting their ride. And basically, you know, I think in our case, we're dealing with, yes, we're dealing with Lane County, but we're dealing with a more confined geographic area that we can combine rides is based on, well, this person's going here and there. The situation you're talking about where it's specifically for dialysis and they're coming
long
from
distance.
One region to another region gets a little bit more complicated. And certainly we do work with the other, you know, CCOs, but it does get a bit more complicated. And Julie's probably a better person to answer that question than I am, because she gets in the
weeds. She was part of the conversation, I believe, too, at the time. It's an interesting problem to have to try and solve, if it is solvable. Any other questions about Lane Transit? Okay. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate you taking the afternoon to be here.
Thank you for having this hearing. We appreciate it.
Ms. Brown, you've traveled the farthest, I believe.
I win the prize.
Thank you.
Well, I don't know. You're right up there, too. I'm Karen McCune and members of the committee. Thank you so much for allowing us and my colleagues an opportunity to come and share with you today. We have a lot of important information. Mm-hmm. And for those who don't know me, my name is Julie Brown. I'm the general manager of Rogue Valley Transportation District in Medford, Oregon. And when we grow up, we want to be like LTD. We want to be RT. But we know we're probably 20 or 30 years off, so I won't talk to you about that today. In addition to talking to you about my transit system, I'm also honored to represent the small urban, rural, and tribal properties throughout the state of Oregon as the chair of the Public Transit Advisory Committee. And so today, I'm going to take you down a rabbit hole, something a little bit different from what you've heard. I am going to talk a little bit about my property, but I also want to talk about how funding happens for the rest of the state. You've heard from the two largest that, you know, they receive the payroll tax. But I have supplied you with some information. I'm not going to do that presentation. I don't want to scare you and think you're going to be here. You told me I had a few minutes, so I'm going to keep it to that.
We're doing just fine.
Okay. But I have given you a couple different documents. One was a presentation I did to the governor's vision panel on transportation, and it talks about the state of transit in Oregon, and it talks not only about some of the different properties, but our funding mechanisms that we have in place. And in addition to that, I've also supplied you with some information on a program called Special Transportation Funds. And this is funds that legislators have actually allocated some additional money. And I'll talk about that as I go on. RVTD is one of five small urban properties. We serve a population, small urban serve between 50 and 100,000 people, or 200,000 people. We receive funding directly from the Federal Transit Administration, and so we are actually very similar to the larger properties, as we are direct recipients, and with that comes a lot. Once you take that federal dollar, again, you're under federal requirements. With that said, all of this operating dollars has a 50% match, which has to come from local. So it may be a property tax, it may be a city or a county giving additional money, or even businesses, but this is what the small urbans face. Our challenges are as real as the large systems. We're required, again, to comply with federal requirements, meet the safety, security, et cetera. I mean, again, once you take that federal dollar, there's a lot to it. With that said, our second challenge is that we are not only serving a mix of high density in maybe in our city center, but then we get into a small rural population or suburb population that we're required to serve, which means a lot of miles, a lot of distance that we are covering. Small urban properties provide fixed route and demand response to the paratransit services, just like the big guys. And we also have a mix of transportation options. So you'll see a lot of the small urbans do things like ride sharing, carpooling. They'll take on different ideas of alternative or transportation options. One of the things that RVTD does, we do the Medicaid transportation along with our fixed route services. We serve 7 counties in southern Oregon. We provide over 200,000 rides a year for those people in the Medicaid population. We have veterans programs and also other programs for a total of about 9 programs in the southern Oregon area. 34 small rural systems that serve populations of 50,000 or less also receive federal funds. Although they aren't distributed by the Federal Transit Administration, they are passed through the Department of Transportation. ODOT has the same requirements that the federal government has, as far as they have to meet those requirements since they received the funds on behalf of the state. And those requirements, again, are passed down through the small rurals. So I've heard some people say, well, at least you're not like TriMet. You don't have those requirements. Wrong. You do. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot to think about when you're thinking about your small rural areas that are trying to provide transportation services and the administrative load that they have to face. These funds, again, carry a 50% match that have to come from a local funding source, and they provide fixed route demand response dial-a-ride programs that have been designed and vetted throughout the community. So what you will find in the small rural areas is the transportation that you see has been vetted in your community. It's been designed to meet the needs of the community. I've now presented to you the federal picture of funding in order to point out the importance of state funding and how this impacts our funding streams. Oregon provides funding for elderly and disabled transportation through a couple revenue streams. One is the cigarette tax. The other is the lawnmower fund. The lawnmower fund? Yeah. Funny place. And Oregon identification cards. Now, when you listen to that, it's what a cobbled mess that can be and how unreliable source of funding that is. These funds are distributed by ODOT through a formula based on population and is referred to as a special transportation fund. This funding is given to 36 counties, so every county receives it. If there is a transportation district in that county, the transportation district actually receives it. And then we also provide funding to 9 recognized tribes. Last year, the state legislature added $10.6 million of general fund to supplement the $15.2 million already identified through the above-mentioned funding systems. The total distribution of elderly and disabled transportation funding came to $25.4 million. The importance of these funds is that they are often used to leverage federal funding. And what I mean by that is we use it to match our vehicle purchases and our operating services. Many of the small rural and urban areas cannot match all our federal funds due to the lack of funding, and we leave opportunity on the table. Now, although those federal funds for some of us don't disappear and we can carry them on to the next year, it just starts adding up to a point where if you don't receive that extra local funding, at some point you lose it. And so there's a missed opportunity. As of February of 2015, the 42 STF agencies have reported the following things. 8 out of the 125 providers that provide special transportation were able to use the funds to match vehicle replacement grants. All of the 42 agencies and their 125 providers will use these funds to sustain and restore operations to former levels. And what I mean by that is there are times that we've had to make significant cuts because the local funding wasn't there. Approximately a third of the entities will use their portion of the funds to match federal funds. a third, and add service for seniors and people with disabilities. The ability to flex funds and to use them for leverage allows systems to somewhat stabilize our funding and bring back service to prior levels and address access, availability, connectivity, and economic development within our local and state levels. This is just really very, very important to us. And I know there's huge ask, and I know I'm not pushing that you make any decision today. But I want you to know in closing that I can't stress how important transportation, public, and other options are to your communities. It really hits home for RVTD. As we face cuts this coming March 23rd, it's inconceivable because last year we had 1.5 million rides on our fixed route service. In addition to that, we provided another 113,000 elderly and disabled transportation rides and another 200,000 to our Medicaid system. Now, you're going to ask me, why are we cutting? Well, we're always looking for that funding. We're always looking for that extra thing that we can do. And we were fortunate enough, because we live in a non-attainment area for air quality, that we were able to get a congestion mitigation air quality grant. It was a three-year project that was funding additional service for evening until 9 o'clock at night and Saturday. What we saw during that 3 years was a growth in our ridership of about 24%. With that said, we're going to have to cut that service. And the reason for that was we went to our local players and our businesses. We also went to the voters and asked them to fund an additional property tax levy for 5 years. It failed in November. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a couple things that contribute to that failure. One was they just passed a 62 cent per thousand levy for the libraries in May. Mm-hmm. And people received their tax bills the same they received their ballot.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Kind of made a difference in our ask. We kick ourselves for not going out in May. But in addition to that, what it has done is it's opened up conversation amongst our community, because all of a sudden businesses and others are asking, what are we going to do and how are these cuts going to impact my constituents, my clients, my business, et cetera. And what they're finding that this is a huge conversation and that it's something that we need to talk about. Transit operating funding is a key missing ingredient for transit agencies to meet rising ridership and operating demands. For operating support to work, the funding needs to be reliable and sustainable so that agencies can add service without the danger of being forced to cut when funding diminishes. In short, operating support provides a reliable transportation network that gets people to jobs. It also gets them to medical and social opportunities. The end result is better livability for Oregonians by reducing, for you, congestion. For us, improving our air quality, and really just meeting the local and social economic needs of the people that we serve. I believe the time is right for you as a committee, and you're faced with really, really hard decisions. But I can tell you that the ODOT staff, the Oregon Transit Association, and the SDF agencies are here as a resource to you. We have the understanding and ability to think outside of the box. And the reason I said that is think about our cobbled together funding sources. We've had to do nothing but think outside the box. We want to let you know that we are personally committed to helping you and that we're here for any questions or any resources that you need. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie. I want to hearken back to one thing again that I mentioned earlier, but I know you've been part of these conversations. When the revenues used to flow for non-emergent medical transport, we've moved into a new world with healthcare, and we formed CCOs, and there seemed to be some disconnect as to how those monies were going to flow through the CCOs for transport. Do you know, are you comfortable with how that is being resolved? I know the conversation was very robust for a period of time. Is that something that's we're moving past now?
I believe we are. I think that there's still some decisions, especially in the Coos Bay area, that they're going to have to make, and they haven't really resolved any of their decision-making on what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. I think that the NEMT was actually placed under transit districts and governmental entities with the thought of they're already providing transit services. Let's build something that we can use that can be part of the network. Unfortunately, under the CCOs, they're handed a pot of money and told go out and provide services without the ability to really understand what those services are, how complicated it can be, and how you can actually build a structure and then tear it apart by not keeping that structure in place. So it has been a challenge for a lot of the agencies who were providing the transportation, but I think that it is resolving.
Good.
I think that eventually we'll be able to build, and I think that there is an understanding amongst the medical community that if you make transit stronger, it's only going to help them get their members to their services. So as you build that system, it's going to help.
It seemed to have been one of those unintended consequences when we transferred into the new medical care system that just wasn't a part of the discussion when it needed to have been. So I'm glad it's resolving. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions for the panel? Yes, Representative Lively.
I just have a question. So it's yours is a special purpose district that was established by the vote of the citizens?
We are. We're a transportation district, and there's different types. That there's a transit district,
yeah.
There's mass transit, transportation districts. When we were formed, the formation was with the property tax.
Okay, that's what I wanted.
So for us, we receive 17 cents per thousand, which is not a lot.
That's the base.
It brings in about $2.4 million a year, which we use to match our federal funds.
And what's your total budget?
Our total budget's $7 million. If we add the Medicaid into it, it actually increases to about $11.
And you charge fares besides?
Yes, we do. I'm not proud to say the highest fare in the state of Oregon. But the riders have actually grown to live with that thought that they need to contribute to.
And just one more question. So when you talked recently about the vote for raising property tax, that was the district, again, that went out for that vote within whoever's within those boundaries?
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you. Question? We're good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
It's
Thank
a great
you.
Education for all of us as we enter into many discussions that are going to impact you along the way. So,
Thank you.
Appreciate it. I will close the informational hearing and open a public hearing on House Bill 2236. Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2236 directs monies from state agency assessments used to provide public transportation services to city transit agencies. It applies to wages paid to state agency employees during calendar years beginning on or after the measure's effective date. The measure would take effect on the 91st day following the adjournment signing day of the legislature. We have no amendments on this measure. We have also received no impact statements. I should mention this measure has a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Brennan. I have two people signed up to speak today, Mr. Lashbrook and Julie Stevens. Come join us. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hello.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Stephen Lashbrook. I'm the transit director for the city of Wilsonville, and I kind of started this ball rolling. Wilsonville is my agency is South Metro Area Regional Transit, which sounds big, but really we're a city department. And the motivation behind this House bill really came from our realization that there are provisions in ORS 291, 405, and 407 that allow state agencies, allow transit districts of the sort that you've just been hearing from, to collect a fee in lieu of payroll tax for state agency employees within their districts. Cities are not afforded that same option. So when I realized that, I approached Representative Davis, and he was nice enough to offer to support this effort. That very simply, all we're trying to do is establish an us too in a state law that's existed for some time, so that we would be able to collect the same kind of revenues if they're available. So I'll elaborate a little bit. And I have to say, Julie and I enjoyed listening to the presentations from our bigger brethren. But we would also love to tell you just about what we do and how our little agencies operate. We're pretty darn proud of what we do. So in real simple terms, what's proposed in this bill would try to level that playing field a little bit for the cities that are transit providers. And I have to tell you, initially, the only cities that would stand to benefit from this are Wilsonville, Sandy, and Canby, because we're the only city transit agencies that levy a payroll tax, and that's what this is really based on. In the case of our system, roughly 75% of our budget is payroll taxes. So a very critical thing for us. We're not transit districts of any of the three kinds that you've just heard about, so we're not able under the current law to receive those revenues. So all this would do is establish that option for the cities that are transit providers. It would also set a limit on the amount of those fees in lieu of payroll taxes that could be collected from state agencies. So it would be capped at the lesser of 0.6%, which is the provision that now is allowed for the districts, or the amount that those cities are already charging. So in our case, Wilsonville's payroll tax rate is 0.5, so we would not even be able to collect the full amount. But that's understood, and we were very deliberate in including that language. The payroll tax otherwise applies only to the private employers within our jurisdiction. And I wanted to say that nothing in what we've proposed in this language is intended to change anything that's in effect for the districts. We see them as and frankly, we are a partner with Salem Kaiser Transit in bus service between Wilsonville and Salem. So we're not out to try to do anything to the districts or take away from them any of the powers or the authority that they have or their fundraising abilities. Rather, we're just, again, kind of raising our hand saying, what about us? I think I'll leave it at that. I would like to talk about medical shuttles and grandpas with green buses, because I'm one of those, too.
Do you have green buses also?
Wow.
I do.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Very cool. Yes.
I see a trend emerging.
Yes, there is.
Yes.
I'm liking it.
Chair McGowan and committee members.
It's McEwen,
thank you.
And you get a pass.
McEwen,
it's
thank
fine.
You.
It happens all the time.
I knew a McGowan once, though.
This comes out lots of different ways, but thank you.
I bet. Well, excuse me.
No problem.
I'm Julie Stevens. I'm the city transit manager for the city of Sandy since its inception, and we've been providing transit service since 2000. We benefit from having withdrawn from TriMet in having our payroll tax. That's why the three cities that are on the outskirts of the Portland metropolitan area can, in fact, support ourselves with a payroll tax, or at least leverage a local funding to meet our federal and state programs. Currently, we provide service between Sandy and Gresham and Estacada. We also are a hub. We act as a hub for transit that goes east to Mount Hood. Clackamas County is now providing transportation all the way up to Timberline Lodge. We provide the connecting service then by benefit of operating between Sandy and Gresham or Estacada to the entire metropolitan area and the Portland International Airport, so that we have many international travelers now using transit who fly into Portland and can go up to our iconic Timberline Lodge. And unlike some of the other systems, we most recently have been able to offer 7-day-a-week service so that that can meet that need, that particular recreational need, through a federal lands access program, again, cobbling together many funds in order to make our systems work. Approximately 200,000 annual trips are provided out of our operating facilities. Our operating budget is just over $1.1 million a year. And we do collect, we get to collect our own transit tax. The payroll tax that we collect is 0.6%. In fiscal year 13, our per capita tax collection rate for the city of Sandy was $28. By comparison, TriMet's in the same year was $173. They do a lot more, but we're able to stretch those local funds a long way because we are smaller and we operate in the manner in which we do. We happen to have a DMV in Sandy. I think the city of Sandy would probably be one of the few benefactors of this if this bill were to go through, and it would give us parity. The in-lieu funds would be welcomed. They would be well used, and we're asking for a due pass today on behalf of the city. Thank you for the opportunity.
This is just a, let's see, are we? We're just a public hearing today, so there will not be a vote today. We will have a work session at a later date.
Okay.
Just didn't want it to raise expectations here. Questions for this panel? Yes. Representative Davis, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for bringing this exciting issue to the to the committee. Could you, Stefan, talk about, you have run this by DAS, I understand, and the governor's office, and I just want to understand what their perspective is.
I had a direct conversation with Carmen Four from the governor's office a few weeks ago, and to her credit, she called me up out of the blue asking about it, and that I thought it was a great conversation. You're not surprised to know she's a very quick study. She knew exactly, as soon as I laid out the background, she knew exactly where it was going. And that was really the gist of that conversation. Other than that, in terms of state agencies that might be affected, Oregon Tech Wilsonville is our biggest state agency employer in Wilsonville that's within our district. And I've talked to the deputy provost who really runs OIT Wilsonville about this. We've had a contractual relationship with them since they opened 3 years ago. And so he also understands that this is in the works.
Thank you.
Representative Lively.
So I have a question. So the authorization for you to be even have access to the payroll tax, so is that I don't understand the origin of that from the standpoint of the municipalities having access to use the payroll tax.
Now, that's interesting. Our agency has been in existence for 26 years, and it was formed that way originally.
Really?
Payroll tax has gone up a little bit through the years. So I can't speak to the history very well.
If I can follow up, please.
Yes.
So you used the payroll tax, so it wasn't state authorization. You chose to use that form locally.
Right, and I think it's probably because TriMet uses that system.
Yeah.
So if you think about Wilsonville in the 1980s, it was a struggle for TriMet to provide service to Wilsonville. They were not unhappy about losing Wilsonville as a client. And what I've had the occasion to say to a number of our businesses is, yes, you are paying for our service. You are making this happen, but you're paying only about two-thirds of the rate you'd be paying if we were in TriMet right now. And look at all this service we provide you.
Sure. Thank you.
Yes, Representative McLean.
Well, I was just wondering how closely Sandy and Wilsonville and Camby actually work together, because to me it seems like you're that mid-group. You know, we've heard from, like you said, the larger groups, but what kind of connection do you folks have as far as helping each other and brainstorming and funding creativity? And
I think we work very closely together, and actually I would say we're the very small agencies. We really are quite small compared to TriMet, Lane, Salem, RVTD. And we collaborate, as I said, when Stefan introduced this bill and came to the OTA, I sit on the board of the OTA and certainly offered to support it, not realizing that we would perhaps be the one city that would benefit from the bill. Mm-hmm. We meet regularly. We sit together on many committees. I spent a lot of time this week with his counterpart talking about grant applications, and they've been to our interviews for contracted services. I'd say we work really closely together. We depend on one another.
I guess the reason I asked it was I wanted that beginning answer, if it's okay, Madam Chair.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the beginning answer about the tax.
No, the buying power. I mean, I just, you know, they're always trying to get people to consolidate or to integrate so you have bigger buying power, more buying power, better buying power. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, every time there's a smaller group or there's more groups, I just always wonder, you know, how much integration there is so that you can help each other, you know, have a better price, you know, on even vehicles or anything else that you have to purchase.
I would say that our collaborations are more in the informal manner, and like I said, staff-wise, because I was able to pull his staff in, they were able to pull me in. We really save each other when we have policies and practices. We talk about it. We have very small staffs. Mm-hmm. I have a staff of 1.8, and that's to do all of the transit collections and all those federal compliances that you just heard about earlier. So we have to maximize our efficiencies. And I think the uniqueness of each of our communities are benefit greatly by our local development and the development locally of our transit systems, Stefan.
So, Madam Chair, a couple of other examples that might help answer this. And we, in fact, provide service to Canby, mm-hmm. And we consider that really part of our commuter service, as well as to Beaverton, Portland, and Salem. So even though we're a little fish, we're in the middle of a lot of action, and we mm-hmm. do provide a lot of services there. But another example of that kind of the benefit of the bigger buying power is we're able to take advantage of what in the industry is known as piggybacking on bus purchases, and Lane Transit has been a big help to us, not only in that way. So, I mean, they may go out and buy, I don't know, 10 or 20 buses at a time, and for us it's one or two, but we're able to use their bid process.
That's great.
And on a couple of different occasions, Lane Transit has actually given us used buses mm-hmm. to help us fill pretty important needs. So
that's great. Thank
There's
you.
A Wilsonville bus in our yard right now on the Mount Hood project.
Right. So there's a lot of that sharing.
Yeah.
Okay. It's very heartening to hear that collaboration is alive and well.
Yeah.
Yes. Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair. And I just want to make a comment and speak to how nimble and flexible municipal agencies like yours are and have been. It's just tremendous in the city of Wilsonville. And I know from Sandy, from friends who live in Sandy, your ability to serve businesses quickly, to serve Oregon Tech quickly with their needs and their changing schedules, to adapt in a way that, you know, understandably for larger agencies, namely the one large agency in the state, something that seemingly takes years to develop a new line or a change in schedule, you know, these agencies, these departments are so nimble and responsive to business that they're very well received in the community. So thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
I thought of one more.
Representative McLean.
We heard about schools, you know, the school children riding or the college student riding the buses. How do you guys do on those? You get kids that go home after activities and those types of things from your high schools? Or
We do. Wilsonville's in the odd position of actually having three school districts within the city limits, but it's primarily the Westland Wilsonville School District. I just met a young man the other day, he's a high school freshman who's a regular rider, and I said, well, you live far enough from the high school, don't you take a bus to school? And he said, oh yeah, but I've been involved in all these after school activities, and I need your bus to get home in the evening.
Yeah. So. Okay.
And we have an interesting situation. Our high school, we were able to build a fabulous high school a couple of years ago, and unfortunately, it moved just enough off of our route that it's a little further away than even their parking lot. And so we lost a lot of our high school student ridership to and from school in town at that time. However, we also offer service over to Estacada, and we have a fair amount of kids that go that ride the bus to go between the two school districts, and they go both directions. There's not a, it's evenly weighted. So, and then I know the Mount Hood Express sees a lot of ridership up the mountain after school activities, so that the kids can participate. Mm-hmm. So, there's no special youth program, but for 14 years we were free. Once we introduced a modest fare of a dollar, we lost a significant amount of ridership. But strangely, they still do find it a good value.
Great. Thank you very much for being here today.
Oh, thank you.
All right. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 2236. Mr. Brennan, what can we expect on Monday?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Monday, we are going to do another informational briefing on another mode. We're going to do freight rail. Monday, we've got a number of folks. Mr. Gard from MoDOT is here. He's going to be there on Monday. And a number of the class ones and a few short lines. And a couple users of the lines will be here to just give a similar briefing to what we had today, except
thank
on
you.
Freight rail.
And we will not be meeting on Friday. I would draw your attention to, in your packet, a report that came from ODOT on the state of transportation and transit in Oregon for your light reading. And on that note, we are adjourned. And on that note, we are adjourned. Again, for your light reading.